So yes, this talk, Walk in the Talk, so this, is the first in a series of three talks. We're doing one tonight on ethics, one tomorrow night on meditation, one on Friday about wisdom. So I thought I'd start with something just came to mind that happened just last week. I was interviewed by someone who comes to the centre. And she's also doing a PhD on mindfulness studies. So she asked if she asked me and a few others if we could have a little interview together. So I said yes. And what she asked me in the interview, one of the things she asked me, she said, "Can you practice meditation without being a Buddhist?" And, well, that was quite an interesting question. And of course, on one level, the answer is yes. I say this myself all the time. Like every week, I teach meditation here to people who are coming to the centre perhaps for the first time. And I always say, you don't have to be a Buddhist to learn to meditate. So it is true. It's not true. But at the same time, I don't believe that you can practice meditation without any reference to the rest of your life, without any reference to your behaviour outside of meditation. I was talking to another woman last week. She'd just come along and she'd learned, I think it was the first time she'd learned the Metta Bhavana. It was her second time to the centre, so she's just learned the practice we'd been doing tonight. And she said, "Can I ask you a question?" And she said, "Do you have to be a vegetarian if you're a Buddhist?" So I, of course, answered very carefully, as I always do. I said, "Well, there aren't any rules in Buddhism," and da-da-da. I said, you know, and I started to say, you know, there aren't any rules, but it would be something that you probably would start thinking about. And she said, "Well, I just don't see how you can wish all beings well and happy and then eat them." In a way, I felt quite abashed because I've been very kind of careful. I wouldn't dare to say that myself, but she said that. I mean, in her case, she was, I found out that she was a practicing vegan in any case. So in a way that corresponded with her belief, you know, in finding the Metta Bhavana, she found something, oh yeah, that, you know, that's, you know, that rings true with what she, you know, held very dearly anyway. Sometimes it's more uncomfortable, that connection between meditation and the rest of our lives. I remember myself that, you know, I definitely, when I began meditating, I thought that I could carry, I didn't even think I could carry on meditation without reference to the rest of my life. I just didn't even think about it at all, actually, at first. But then, quite soon after I learned to meditate, forgive me if you've heard me saying this before. My true bandhu is another teacher. He always says a good teacher doesn't keep giving the same example. So if he was here, I'd be shamefaced because I've given this example many times. But I think it's quite a good one. When I first learned to meditate, I was meditating away, and then it started to be that I couldn't meditate without feeling sick anymore. Every time I sat down to meditate, I just felt really so sick and nauseous, I had to stop meditating. I couldn't understand it. And so I asked somebody, you know, who was a bit more experienced, well, you know, what's going on? How come, you know, this meditation, I just feel sick every time I meditate? And she said something that totally baffled me at the time. She said, "Well, what's going on in the rest of your life?" I said, "What a strange thing to ask. It didn't make sense." And she said, "No, you know," she coaxed me. She said, "What's going on with the rest of your life?" And actually, in the rest of my life, you know, I was in a bit of a mess. I was particularly in a situation where I was being quite deceitful and, you know, just, not behaving very well in regard to someone else. So eventually I sort of admitted this to her. And I remember I said, "Well, I'm doing this. I was having an affair, actually. I might as well tell you." So I was having, I was much younger. And I said, well, you know, I'm having this affair, and da da da. And I said, I don't see what that's got to do with my meditation, you know. And she, of course, well, skillfully managed to show me, well, that, you know, that had everything to do with why I couldn't meditate anymore. I just, you know, I thought, as I say, I could meditate without reference to the rest of my life, but I couldn't. There was a, you know, a tension there that just wasn't sustainable. Something had to give. So I'm glad to say that I did, you know, sort out that situation and was then able to keep on meditating. And obviously it was good that I sorted out this mess that I was in. So basically, to myself, my own experience tells me that to be able to meditate, we need to look at our behaviour in the rest of our life. In other words, this brings us into the realm of ethics, the subject of my talk. And our behaviour in the rest of our life and our meditation is a reciprocal relationship. So, you know, as the other young woman said, well, if you're meditating, wishing all beings well, and then at the same time actually harming them outside your life, you know, that's a conflict. Whereas if you're trying to be kinder outside meditation, that's going to feed into your practice, or particularly the metta bhavana. That then is going to feed back into your life, so you start to be kinder as a person. Same with the practice of the mindfulness of breathing. If you're trying to be more mindful and aware when you're not meditating, that will feed into your meditation. That in turn will feed back into your life. So you've got this real kind of positive feedback loop starting to happen, which isn't always comfortable. I remember my first meditation teacher once said, he said, oh, you think you're coming to learn to meditate to change your life, and then you realise you have to change your life in order to meditate. I thought, oh, you know, I wasn't quite sure about that at first. So that's on the one hand. So the connection between our meditation and the ethical dimension of life. At the same time, I also don't think you can practice meditation for any length of time, you know, and with any kind of depth, without starting to get glimpses that there's much more to the mind, much more to being a human being than previously you may have thought. We had a lovely example. We had a symposium of talks here last night, and some of the speakers were talking about their meditation practice. And Kate, who's here again tonight, she was talking about, you know, would encountering, discovering through meditation really expanded states of consciousness. And that afterwards, the world looked like quite a different place after that. What she said, what she previously, I hope she doesn't mind me quoting her a little bit, there she is. She said what she previously had thought of was herself, she saw that was a bit like a mask, a veneer to her really true self. So I thought that it was a very lovely evocation of meditation. So I think if you're starting to meditate at all seriously, then you start to question assumptions you've made about what it is to be human, about the very nature of that. Sangha Rajta, our teacher, the founder of this movement, he talks about you start to interrogate reality. I liked that. So the experience Kate shared with us was particularly vivid, I thought. There might be, you know, you might not have such a vivid experience, but I still think you might get it in a more gradual way. I was talking to someone else this morning, just after the morning meditation here, and she was talking about being on retreat last winter. And at the end of that retreat, just as at the end of the summer retreat, it seems bonfires are a traditional thing at the end of these retreats, that she was talking about this bonfire that we had at the end of the retreat. And she said it was funny, you know, because usually when I see bonfire, I'm thinking, you know, where's the fireworks? You know, where's the things to eat? You know, and there wasn't any of that. She said, but what she found was, what she realised was, I'm thinking, where's the fireworks? You know, where's the eats? You know, she wasn't ever looking at the bonfire, actually. And then because there weren't, you know, in a way it was much simpler, it was just this bonfire. She said, oh, I really looked at the bonfire and it was really beautiful. And it was beautiful in all its phases, where it was flaring up and where it was dying down. So I think, again, that's a realisation, the realisation that there is a deep satisfaction in paying attention to what's actually happening. So again, that's a bit of a glimpse that there's more to life than perhaps we usually think. So I think through meditation, quite naturally, we get glimpses of vision. We get glimpses of experiences that introduce us to a larger reality. Of course, meditation is not the only way we get that, but meditation is one of the ways. So I thought you could say, if you kind of think of meditation in the middle, as it were, you could think of meditation as descending into our action, into our behaviour, and ascending into vision. So you've got meditation in the middle, our ethical behaviour, it's descending down into that, ascending into vision. And that ascent into vision, glimpses of vision, that too will have an effect on how you live your life. That's also a reciprocal relationship. So if those glimpses of vision are a bit like flashes of lightning, then wisdom, with a capital W, is like total illumination. It's like what happens when all those flashes have joined up. And when that happens, when all those flashes kind of join up, as they were, and you get total illumination, then your whole ethical life would be transformed in accordance with that. At the same time, the development of wisdom is only possible on the basis of an ethical life. So that's what I mean, when I say there's this kind of reciprocal relationship, this positive feedback loop. So for Buddhists, we see the Buddha, born a human being, as we heard, but who's become through his own efforts a Buddha. So Buddhists see the Buddha as someone for whom these flashes of lightning have indeed joined up. So the Buddha would dwell in this total illumination of perfect wisdom, and that's joined with supreme compassion and unbounded energy. And that state of perfect wisdom, supreme compassion, unbounded energy in pursuit of the good, that's what we call enlightenment, the permanent and unconditioned state of enlightenment. So in a paper by an order member called Attila, who lives around the London Buddhist Centre, he describes the Dharma as the communication, the teachings, the ever-repeating call of that state, that enlightened state, within conditioned existence, through texts and images and archetypes and symbols. And he describes the Sangha as the community of hearers that are receptive to the call of Buddhahood. And he says the Sangha is the imaginative recreation and embodiment of the ideal within our thought, speech and action. And then he says, the development of the individual is the process of a deepening response and alignment of the will to the call of Buddhahood. I really like that, so I'll just read that again. The development of the individual is the process of a deepening response and alignment of the will to the call of Buddhahood. I like that very strongly, you get the idea of call and response. The paper itself is called Call and Response. So you've got the call of the Buddha, as it were, and then the response. And this, it chimes in with something I've been thinking about recently myself. The creative tension between thinking for and realising things for oneself and listening to and responding to teachings. So that's what I want to explore a bit in this talk. So there's loads of teachings in Buddhism, and they take lots of forms. As I was saying, they take the form of texts and images and symbols, probably even more. So for this talk, for this walking the talk, I want to focus on the teaching, one particular teaching, that actions have consequences, i.e. the teaching on ethics. So the Buddhist teaching is that unethical, or as it's called in Buddhism, unskillful actions hinder our development as human beings, and therefore they undermine our happiness, especially the happiness that results from a clear conscience. I really come to value that more and more, actually, the value of having a clear conscience. I really come to sort of appreciate more and more that kind of no matter what happens, even my biggest disappointments that happen, if my conscience is clear, then I feel basically okay. And the opposite is true, you know. I think the pain of having an unclear conscience, I think there's kind of no suffering like that, really. There's that horrible feeling, which you might have guessed from Sagadasa's introduction that I know quite well, you know. You know, you've been angry, you know, you've been selfish. So, you know, just a very, very kind of painful feeling. I think that's the kind of deepest kind of pain. So to define this term that I'm using, unskillful, and some of us have heard this definition, but I think we can never be reminded of it too often, actually. In Buddhism, unskillful actions of body, speech and mind are simply actions that are rooted in greed, hatred and delusion. That's all it means. So it's psychological rather than theological. It's not unskillful because somebody else has said it is bad or something. It's unskillful because it's coming from greed, hatred and delusion. And the Buddha, if you were a Buddha, if you were enlightened, then you'd have the perspective to see that ultimately acting from greed, hatred and delusion is the cause of all our suffering, all of it, actually. You've got to be you've got to be careful that you don't take that to say, oh, I don't know, if I fell over now and broke my leg, that would mean that's because I was angry last week or something. You've got to be careful at looking at it that way around. It's better to look at it the way around. If I act unskillfully now, suffering will definitely follow. That's the Buddhist teaching. We can test these things out in our own experience, by the way. Don't take it as true just because the Buddha or me or anybody said it's true, but that would be the Buddhist teaching. If we act unskillfully, suffering will definitely follow. If we act skillfully, happiness will definitely follow. Most of the time we haven't got that perspective. I know I certainly haven't. Something I think about quite a lot is to do with an experience that some of us will have had, maybe even most of us will have had, and that's the experience of someone you really love, doing something that's really, really destructive. To witness somebody you love doing something that, you know, is just, you can see is really, really destructive. If you've had that experience, and I imagine many of us had, it's so painful and difficult. Myself, my brother, for quite a number of years, was involved in an abusive relationship, a physically abusive relationship. you know, it's horrible. You know, it's horrible to see someone who's been beaten up. It's just really, it's awful to see that kind of physical injury on someone. Awful to see, well, just the shame and the confidence growing lower and lower through a result of being involved in that kind of relationship. And it's awful to see that person keeping going back. Just keeping going back. You're kind of all the time. It's so hard not to think, oh, I wish I could make them not go back. You want to sort of say, just why are they going back? It's so hard to understand. Why are they going back? Why are they going back? And then they come home and, you know, you see what's happened to them. Yeah, so it's just so painful, isn't it, to see someone that you love causing their own pain, actually. And what I often think is that from the Buddha's perspective, we're all doing that. That is what the Buddha sees. The Buddha sees, as it were, that we're all doing that, that we're all causing our own suffering. And that that is the tragedy of the human condition. That we want to be happy, but we cause our own suffering. So the Buddha sees that. So from the Buddhist point of view, being unskillful isn't so much bad as being deeply misguided. And the response of the enlightened mind and heart to that is total compassion. Like someone who's enlightened, who's seen you make those misguided mistakes, isn't going to punish you for doing that. They're going to feel like total compassion. That's the response of the enlightened mind. It's as if the Buddha is saying to us, and this is what all the Buddhist teachings are about, it's as if the Buddha is saying to us, look, you don't have to suffer like this. If you just let go of craving, you would be free of suffering. If we don't pay heed to those teachings, the Buddha's just going to feel, as it were, the Buddha's going to feel compassion to us, towards us. The other thing that I find useful to reflect on in relation to that is if we did have that perspective, it would totally change how we responded to others being unskillful. We'd be able to see that even if it doesn't look like it now, that if someone's been unskillful, they will suffer. In fact, they are suffering. It's not that they will suffer, it's they are suffering. A truly happy person does not do a cruel thing. If we could see that, then it would completely dissolve, dissolve any desire for retribution, revenge, hatred, and so on, if we could see with the eyes of the Buddha. So go back to that quote I gave you from Attila's paper. He describes the Sangha as the community of hearers receptive to the call of Buddhahood, the imaginative recreation and embodiment of the ideal within our thought, speech and action. So the Buddha would quite naturally and spontaneously act in ways expressive of generosity, love and clarity, i.e. the opposite of greed, hatred and delusion. The Buddha wouldn't be sort of trying to do that, as it were. That would be the natural expression. But because we haven't got that insight of the Buddha yet, we don't spontaneously act like that. But we can imagine how the Buddha would act. And we can do that because we've got some flavour of those states ourselves. I mean, we know what it's like to be a bit generous and a bit kind, don't we? And by acting in the way that an enlightened being would, then that transforms our consciousness. That actually changes us. And Bhante Sangharakshita's got an analogy, which again I'm very fond of quoting, so forgive me if you've heard me quoting this before, that I think really describes this very beautifully. He says it's like a poet and a poem. I mean, it would do for any work of art, actually, but say stick to a poet and a poem. So the poet writes the poem out of his or her inspiration. So that flows out of their inspiration. We read the poem, so we maybe are not that inspired, but then we read the poem, and then by reading it, we become more inspired. So that's like the Buddha. So the Buddha is like the poet. So in a way, the Buddha's life is the poem. And if we, and us acting in the way the Buddha would act, or trying to do that, that's like us reading the poem. And then that raises us up. That actually transforms our consciousness. So in order to do that, of course, we have to think in a bit more detail, well, how would the Buddha act? Obviously, I've said the Buddha would act based in generosity, love and clarity. But well, what would that look like? What would that look like in a bit more detail? We just kicked off the urban retreat on Saturday there. Quite a few people in this room were there. And we were really looking at this kind of thing for ourselves. We were making resolutions, even precepts for ourselves. And we were trying to get them in as much detail as possible, because we realised that that's what would make us more, you know, likely to do them. So we were kind of chunking down, as it were, that kind of, you know, say you kind of wished, oh well, I'm going to be generous all week, you know. It's kind of, it's more helpful, I think, to think, well, what is that going to look like? I'm going to, you know, wash the dishes 3 times, you know, on Monday, Wednesday and Friday. The more we can chunk it down, the easier it is for us actually to do it. So in thinking in more detail how a Buddha would actually act, the Buddhist tradition has evolved a set of precepts. There's different lists of precepts. In the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, we usually talk about 5 or 10 precepts. These precepts that Buddhists chant, for example, like a lot of us would chant this list of precepts every day. What is very, very important to realise that these precepts, it's not that they're generating our conscience. Our conscience is inbuilt. So again, this is a really important point, actually, that as a human being, our conscience is inbuilt. We know that, don't we? We feel that. We know what it's like to feel remorse when we've let ourselves or other people down. That's part of being human. We've all felt that. You might be thinking, well, if it's innate, if this conscience is innate, why do we need precepts at all? And the reason is because, well, our ethical impulses aren't the only ones that we've got. Our positive ethical impulses are competing with all sorts of things, aren't they? Our other ones to kind of grasp and be selfish and so on. Also, they can get blunted or even suppressed, our ethical impulses. So basically, although it's innate to have a conscience, it's an innately human thing to have a conscience, according to the teachings of Buddhism anyway. Again, you can test this in your own experience. The actual manifestation of that kind of moral intuition, if you like, it kind of waxes and wanes. You know, it depends on what choices you make, what conditions you're in, and so on. So the precepts are there to draw out this moral sense. And if we practice them, our conscience will get more tender. And that's kind of what we're aiming at. We want to get more ethically sensitive rather than that ethical sense to be blunted. So we intentionally support that process of becoming more ethically sensitive by the practice of the precepts. So the precepts are, the 5 precepts are, I undertake to abstain from taking life. I undertake to abstain from taking the not given. I undertake to abstain from sexual misconduct. I undertake to abstain from false speech. I undertake to abstain from taking intoxicants. So I waited quite a long time before I gave you that list. I wanted to give a particularly long preamble to that list, because I hoped that that would help to show that on the one hand, these precepts aren't a list of rules to be followed in a legalistic way, and at the same time aren't just vague intentions. They're trying to draw out this innate moral sense that we've got. But actually, although I've given a very long preamble, I realise that no matter how long a preamble I gave, we definitely will fall into treating them as rules. We just will, because our human nature seems to be that we literalise things very easily. So we're bound to fall into treating them as rules. And then when we do that, depending on our temperament, we're either going to desperately try and keep them for fear of reward, you know, for fear of punishment or hope of reward, or else we're going to react to them and say, no, you know, I have nothing to do with them. I'm just going to kind of follow my own heart or whatever. And the reason why I'm being so kind of assured when I'm saying we definitely will do that is because that we're not yet maybe some of us are. Maybe I should only speak for myself, actually. What I was going to say was that we're not yet what Sangharakshita calls true individuals, but I have made an assumption in saying that no one in this room is a true individual. So I'll tell you what a true individual is, and then you'll know whether you are one or not. So a true individual is someone who is free. And particularly, a true individual is someone who is free from needing approval from others. And another one of the talks last night, Henry was saying that sometimes, I hope again he doesn't mind me quoting him, he was saying that sometimes he worries, oh, well, what will people think if I tell them I'm a Buddhist? And he said, oh, what will my mother think? And then, what will even people I don't even know think, you know? I'm sure that Henry wasn't alone in having that kind of thought. And again, I hope he doesn't mind me quoting him, because I thought that was just really, that's what we all get like, you know? We think, well, what will people think? You know, I think that's what happens when we are, when we're not yet free from needing approval. It's interesting, this true individual thing, because on the one hand it's about not kind of, you know, wanting approval and kind of love and everything from other people, but at the same time it doesn't mean just reacting against that, because in a sense if we're reacting against it, you're still bound up. When we're reacting, we're still bound up with what we're reacting against. A true individual in Sangharakshita's definition would be totally spontaneous. The sort of inner and outer would be totally congruent, and you'd have a really deep trust of yourself. You wouldn't care what people think, but yet at the same time you wouldn't be sort of deliberately trying to go against what people think. You'd just be like totally acting from your own fullness of being. And if you were a true individual, then you could follow a discipline in a free way. So I just want to read you something from this book, which I've drawn some of the talk from, Living Ethically by Sangharakshita. He says, well, many people in the West tend to confuse an unhealthy desire for self-mortification based on feelings of guilt, self-hatred and self-contempt with a healthy appreciation of the need for self-discipline. The word asceticism comes from the Greek word ascesis, which simply means training. So he says, well, it's just like the athlete trains the body, so the spiritual practitioner trains the mind. And that this is quite different from self-mortification. Though, he says, it must be admitted, this is interesting, that much of what passes for self-discipline is in fact neurotic self-mortification. It seems that we often find it easier to punish ourselves than to apply true self-discipline. We're happy to indulge ourselves, we're happy to punish ourselves, but the middle way of self-discipline and spiritual training we find almost impossible to follow. And he goes on to say that this is partly because much of what is really simply self-discipline we tend to think of as a form of self-mortification. So it seems he thinks we do it kind of both ways round. And he gives the example, he says, a person who eats meat, for example, is likely to regard giving it up as an act of self-denial rather than as a part of a training. So I thought very interesting to ponder upon that. I'm very interested that he talks about guilt, which is something, again, I thought about a lot. For a lot of my life, I believed that guilt was a virtue, actually. And I was very kind of pleased but shocked to realise that in Buddhism, guilt itself would be regarded as an unskillful, i.e. unhelpful mental state. And there's a lovely, I find very useful, kind of checklist, really, that Sangha actually gives of how to kind of tell whether we're actually feeling guilt. He says that there's at least three factors present in guilt. The consciousness of having done something that somebody else didn't want you to do, that's number one. The fear that you're going to get punished when you're found out. Even if you haven't done it yet, you kind of think, well, if I do it, I'll get punished. And then the most telling one of all, the person who doesn't want you to do the thing, or maybe even you just imagine they don't want you to do it, is someone on whom you're emotionally dependent. Someone without whose love you feel you can't live, you feel you can't manage without their love. And you fear that as a punishment, they're going to withdraw that love. I find that very, very interesting. If I'm in a kind of state of thinking, oh, wait, what am I feeling here? You know, if I'm feeling sort of sorry that I've done something, I find that a useful checklist to see is what I'm actually feeling, just a healthy remorse, or is it this kind of more kind of convoluted feeling of guilt? So a true individual isn't governed by whether they're going to get the approval of others. So in a sense, you can only be truly ethical if you're a true individual. If you've kind of risen above, as it were, these poles of conformity on the one hand and individualism, which is a term Sangha just coined to talk about that sort of where you're just reacting. Of course, this is, you know, it's all going to take practice. I think particularly the practice of the metta bhavana. But then going back to Attila's statement, the development of the individual is the process of a deepening response and alignment of the will to the call of Buddhahood. Just read that again. The development of the individual is the process of a deepening response and alignment of the will to the call of Buddhahood. Very interesting statement. It reminds me of a prayer that somebody wrote to the Buddha that I was just reading the other day. And the last line of this prayer was, help me to be you, help me to be myself. And that was very interesting because that's a seeming paradox, isn't it? How can we be more ourselves and at the same time aligning our will to something that to all intents and purposes seems to be outside ourselves? But then again, if you think about it, we actually do have experience of this, I'm sure. And again, Sangha Rajta helped me to think about this in something he wrote, where he says, if there's someone you love and they ask you to do something and you do it, well, whose will is it? Very interesting that, isn't it? My friend Vajraganta's got a text she stored on her mobile phone where apparently I've said to her, I'll do anything you ask. It was a bit alarmed she stored this on her phone. She had rung me up one day, said, will you do me a favour? And, you know, I did feel that. I thought, oh, yeah, I'll do anything you ask. And she's kept that safe, her future. But, you know, I really felt that. And then that's interesting, isn't it? Whose will is it? You know, is it her will or is it my will? It's both our wills, actually. They're blended together. You know, and if you really love someone, it's not even just that you're willing, is it? You're delighted. You're delighted to do what that person asks. And then Sangharaja says, well, if the person who called, as it were, was a Buddha and you responded, then your will becomes blended with the will to enlightenment. For this to work, for this kind of blending of wills thing to work, you need two qualities. You need intelligence and you need receptivity. You need both of them. In order to hear the call, you have to be receptive. So in relation to Buddhist ethics, being receptive would mean being open to the idea, at least provisionally, that how we act has an effect on our minds. That how we act will ultimately determine whether we develop wisdom in its fullest sense. It would mean being open to the idea that the 5 or 10 precepts are indeed a detailed working out of that. And moreover, it would mean being willing to practice these precepts even when we don't feel like it, even when we don't quite see the immediate point of one or other of them. But we do that consciously. We do that without abnegating our responsibility. So again, I've got what I think is quite a good example of this from my own life, where I was given a precept by someone else and I took it on even though I couldn't see the point of it. I couldn't see any benefit to myself. In fact, my inclination was the exact opposite. So again, forgive me if you've heard this before. It's another one I'm rather fond of telling, but I think it is quite a good illustration. So it's something that happened when I was about 29 or 30 years old. And I just had a kind of quite long but really difficult relationship. And then I'd had a quite short but difficult relationship. And then I thought, okay, you know, where's my next, you know, that they didn't work, so it's time to have a good relationship now. So I was kind of all set up for my next relationship. But it was just it was just kind of in my mind at this point. And then my friend Ratnadarni said to me, would you not just give it a rest, you know, would you not just give it a rest just for a short while? And I said, no, I've had this, you know, not very nice relationship, then I've had this not very nice one. You know, I deserve to, you know, have a nice one now. She said, look, you know, could you not just do it, just for me, you know, just for a month, she said, could you not just forget the idea? And I remember thinking, oh, I'm not really into this thing she's suggesting. You know, it doesn't chime in with what I want to do. And I thought, well, it's not going to kill me, is it? It's not going to kill me. Just a month, you know. And so I thought, I'll do it. And I'll do it because she's asked me to do it. And then, interestingly enough, I found it was one of the richest experiences of my life, actually. The month then expanded to a year, which was quite a big thing for me at that age in my 20s, coming up for 30. And then that expanded into 2 years. And then, yeah, it was a very, very rich experience of life. But I would never have chosen to do that willingly myself without that. Well, in a way, more than suggestion, as she directly asked me to do it. So I did. I could only do that because I felt receptive to her. She was a friend I held and still hold in very high regard. So I was receptive to her, even obedient to her, you could say. But at the same time, I don't think I abnegated my own responsibility. I still had my own intelligence, as it were. I did it consciously. I thought I'll try it and see if it works. And it did work, so I kept trying it. So, well, we've got to use our intelligence to test the teachings. And we've also got to use our intelligence to apply the teachings to ourselves in our practice. So in order to respond to the teachings, in this case the teaching that actions have consequences, we need, as I say, these two essential qualities, intelligence and receptivity. Both of them. We need, so Ratnagunar, another author, he says that intelligence without receptivity is just cleverness or rationalisation and will tend to lead you to individualism, this word I used earlier. Receptivity without intelligence is just naivety or gullibility, and that will tend to lead you to conforming to authority or perceived authority. So you need both. In a way, this is the kind of crux of what I'm hoping I'm communicating, that you need both. You need an intelligent receptivity, a receptive intelligence. Of course, though, we will tend to one or the other. If we're not true individuals, we will tend to one or the other. We will be pushed and pulled by that need for love and approval, not tend us to one or the other. So all we can do, as with anything, is to notice that and to try and respond creatively. Another quote from Sangharakshita from this book, Living Ethically. He says, if there's a discrepancy between the way we are and the way we aspire to be, what's lacking is not so much the ability to be other than we are at present, but the courage to be honest about where we really stand. If we can do this, then we're already making great progress. So I thought that was great. The courage to be honest about where we really stand. And Ratnaguna, the other author I quoted, said to respond creatively, happily even, to the awareness of our imperfections and try to overcome the imperfection. This is the essence of the spiritual life. So in other words, not reacting to that awareness of our imperfections by sort of either ignoring it or trying to suppress it on the one hand, or becoming despondent or discouraged, but by responding creatively to the awareness of our imperfections. So that to me is when we're walking the talk. Just as simple yet as challenging as that. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, Subharamati, for a wonderful talk. I was really pleased by the way she put the ethics into a very wide context of the spiritual life, especially by making the connection with the Buddha and the Buddha as an example. And I felt sort of gently taken by the hand and have a quick, short look at this beast of guilt. And I was really glad you took me by the hand and then let it go to reflect upon later. And I really, really didn't mind you giving your examples. Some of them I hadn't heard before anyway. And they're recorded now, so we're going to hear them again and again and again. And until they sort of really sink in and make a difference. So I hope you go away with something to think about and to reflect about and to become more aware of your own behaviour in your life and how meditation relates to ethics. If you're interested in the other subjects, then do come back and listen to the talks here about meditation and wisdom. Thank you very much for your attention and have a very good urban retreat, and another round of applause for Subharamati. Thank you.